Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 328 for April 15th of 2016. Toyota's fuel cell is right here. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Auto Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary, you want to do a show?
Why don't we do that with advanced technology?
Okay, why don't we get Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press here? Oh,
I'm
Mark.
Sorry, I'm busy.
Great having you back on the show here,
Thank
Mark.
You.
Always good to have you here. And we got to let everybody know, we got Jackie Birdsall, the chief engineer.
Oh.
Is that right? No, what's your title, Jackie?
I'm a senior engineer.
Senior engineer,
yes.
With Toyota. Working on the fuel cell car, the Toyota Mirai.
Correct.
And we've got it here in the studio. As we keep telling everybody, we love having engineers and their product in here in the studio.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what's your involvement in the car? Because most of this was done in Japan, right?
That's now, right, yeah.
But you're here in Michigan?
Our team is actually located in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
The team that I work with, we do North American suitability of the vehicle. So it is developed mainly in Japan, the components. It's built at the Motomachi plant in Japan. But then we get the prototype vehicles, and we take them to Death Valley. We take them to Yellowstone. We make sure that they work, you know, really.
So you're involved in all the testing of this stuff?
All of the testing of it, down to even the high-pressure storage system, which is actually my specialty.
High-pressure storage of?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen.
That's correct, yes.
How high a pressure are you talking about?
We store it at 10,000 PSI in this vehicle.
Wow. So the tank... The fuel tank has mm-hmm. literally got to be bulletproof, right?
It does, yes.
You can shoot, what, 30-odd six into this thing and the bullets will bounce off.
They sure will, yep.
And there's two tanks,
pretty difficult,
right?
To get. That's correct, yes.
Two tanks. Not just one.
Really?
Yes.
Why two?
Because since they are cylinders, they're non-conformable, so you have to figure out a way to design around them, and obviously designing around one large tank is a bit more difficult to keep your passenger space versus designing around two smaller tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And we still want the amount of hydrogen that we have on board to get the range, which is about 312 miles for this vehicle on a 5-minute fill.
What's the material that you actually make the tanks out of? Because in some of the early days of fuel cell, that was one of the questions. How will they be able to get something that you can shoot a bullet into? How can you? Because people were afraid of the Hindenburg effect, even though we all know the Hindenburg wasn't caused by hydrogen, but people still get a little nervous. So what's the material you use?
I can't tell you how happy that makes me to hear you say that. You just saved me an answer. The tanks are made of three layers. So there's a plastic layer that is what essentially holds the hydrogen in. It keeps it from being able to permeate through the other layers. So that's kind of the layer that contains the hydrogen. And then there's a carbon fiber layer on top of that that gives it the strength. So it's a really thick carbon fiber. That's where the bulletproof comes from. And on top of that, we have a glass fiber layer that protects the carbon fiber layer if you were to drop the tank, any kind of surface damage on the carbon fiber.
And we're talking about just a couple of cylinders that look like scuba tanks or welding, you know, tanks that are just crosswise in the car. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And 10,000 PSI because the higher the pressure, the more you can pack in there, right? And the greater the range.
Exactly. Yep. We get more range out of the higher pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So what causes the car to go? What powers the vehicle? So when you have the hydrogen, but then it's used to do what?
So this vehicle is a hybrid in that we have the hybrid synergy drive on board. And so if you're familiar, well, I know you guys are familiar. I don't have to say if you're familiar. You are familiar with our hybrid synergy drive. So sometimes it goes from the battery, sometimes directly from the motor, but it's always kind of working together. In this case, instead of having a gasoline engine, we have the fuel cell that creates the electricity on demand that powers the electric motor. And then instead of having the gasoline tanks, we have the hydrogen tanks that feed the fuel cell that creates the electricity. So it's an all-electric vehicle, but we still have the battery to capture the regenerative braking, because although the fuel cell can create electricity, it can't store it. So we still have those components that we borrow from our hybrid synergy drive vehicles and then just made it up with a fuel cell.
And the fuel cell is one of those things that looks like magic to a person who's not an engineer. It's a chemical reaction, and hydrogen, you know, goes in and electricity and water come out, right?
It is actually.
You
magic.
Forgot the magic.
It
wand.
Is magic.
Yes,
it is magic.
Sorry.
Unicorn tears.
But explain,
you know, the whole,
explain
the whole day.
Jackie, explain it in very simple terms. How does a fuel cell work?
So it is. Oh, it's called an electrochemical reaction, and we introduce hydrogen on one side that comes from the tanks, and then oxygen on the other side that just comes from the air from the intake system, and the two see each other and they want to bond. So hydrogen's always bonded to something. It's never just floating in the atmosphere by itself. It has a very strong affinity to want to have a partner. So we introduce the oxygen on the other side of a membrane. We have a catalyst there, a small platinum layer that catalyzes the oxygen and the hydrogen. The protons and electrons break off of each other. And the membrane in the middle is called a proton exchange membrane, which allows the proton to travel through, but the electron cannot. So the electron's stuck on one side trying to get to its proton and its oxygen, and it can't get through there, but we provide a conductive circuit around the outside. So it finds that, finds its proton friend, the oxygen, forms water, and goes out the tailpipe. But you get that flow of the electrons going, and that flow creates electric current.
So the membrane's got inky-dinky little holes in it that protons can fit through.
But electrons cannot. It's not conductive, right.
And nature hates instability.
Absolutely.
And as they want to rejoin, that flow of electrons is the electricity that powers the car.
It is one of the simplest chemical reactions, and we just introduce the right conditions for it to take place.
And these fuel cells are making amazing progress. I mean, we've been talking, the three of us journos here have been writing about fuel cells forever, but it looks like it's finally starting to really come to happen, at least from a cost standpoint.
Absolutely, yeah. And it wasn't just the fuel cell itself, but also the components that we've mated to the fuel cell, what we call the balance of plant, that make this the reaction happen, the reaction possible, that the decrease in the cost of all those components that have made us able to launch them Mirai last year.
Well, and there was the whole question of how do you store, which was a major stumbling block for a while, and you did figure out how to, you know, carry enough hydrogen on board that gives you, you said, about 300-mile range?
Yes, we have an EPA label for 312 miles. But it was interesting when we first started the vehicles, we were looking at, you know, all the automakers were kind of starting to get into the space and play with fuel cells and hydrogen and do onboard reformation. But you can imagine having a reformer mm-hmm. onboard a vehicle. It's kind of difficult. Looked at liquid hydrogen, but it is a cryogenic liquid, so you're dealing with, you know, extremely cold temperatures, and how do you transfer that into the vehicle? So we started at about 3,600 PSI, which is what CNG vehicles use, and then wanted more range, so up to 5,000 PSI. That was still doable, and we said, oh, well, how about 10,000 PSI will get us that range that we think the customers really need out of a vehicle like this.
And this vehicle is actually running on public roads now. You know, what is the status of this as far as, you know, going from lab to real world, a person can you know, buy it and fuel it?
Mm-hmm. So we did launch it in October last year in the U.S. It was launched in Japan first, so it's on the road in Japan, in Europe, and right now only in California in the U.S. And it's unfortunately because we do have to launch it where there's infrastructure, because you don't want to give someone a car where they can't fill it. That would be pretty up.
And in this case, infrastructure means someplace where you can buy a tank of hydrogen.
Yep, someplace where you can go to a filling station. Right now, the dispensers are co-located with gasoline, except I think maybe one station. No, they're all co-located. So you pull up to where a gasoline retail location is, and there's a hydrogen dispenser, and you pull up very similar to refilling with gasoline. It takes about 5 minutes, gives you over 300 miles range.
Pretty good. And these are for normal people, not just for test pilots who are driving these things around.
These are for normal people, yeah. And you can buy and lease the Mirai, which mm-hmm. was a first for fuel cell vehicles.
You can buy them.
You can buy them.
I did not know. I thought you could only lease them. That's pretty interesting. So, we've already got a bunch of questions come in. Steve B. has this question. You talked about the tank being bulletproof, or the tanks. He says, what about the fuel lines? What happens if a line is broken or punctured?
That is an excellent question. The whole system itself gets, so we test the tanks and the system, the high pressure system, which anything from the receptacle, which is where you connect the nozzle when you refill, to the mid pressure regulator, which is where we step down the pressure to go into the fuel cell stack because it's running at very low pressure. That whole system is called the compressed hydrogen storage system. And we test the whole thing to what's called the global technical regulation. And that is a UN document that gets adopted by Europe, by Japan, and is being adopted by the U.S., and that includes all kinds of crazy tests to ensure that a certain leakage rate, a very low permeability, is allowed from the system. So that includes, all of our materials are selected appropriately for hydrogen. All of the fittings are appropriately tightened or the appropriate type of connector. But then also the amount of fuel allowed in those lines. So if you were to have some kind of release of one of those lines, say one of those lines was compromised in a crash or something like that, it would be a very, very small volume if you look at the inside diameters.
So you've really got a shutoff valve somewhere, basically.
We also have shutoff valves. That includes requirements for shutoff valves for thermally activated pressure relief devices, collision safety sensors that will, in a collision, isolate the tank system. So if there is some way that the line were to be compromised, it would be a low volume, and the solenoid valve is a fail-safe, so fail-shut.
So you've smashed, bashed, and crashed this thing, not just simulated it to see that it works?
Oh, no, yeah. This has been through the ringer.
I've driven the car. It's in fact, I think our colleague Dennis Semenitis had the best line about it. He said, the most remarkable thing about the Mirai is how unremarkable it is.
It's my line.
Is it?
Yes.
Well, maybe he stole it from you.
He must have. Trademarked it.
You should have. But, I guess that's leading up to a question. You've put these in the hands of consumers. I know they're all going to come back and say, we love it. But what are you learning from them that, maybe we should do this or we could change that?
So far, definitely the majority of the feedback has been, we love the car. I would say that the greatest learnings we've had so far is where there's room for improvement in the infrastructure side. Which we knew.
Everybody knew that going in. Right?
We knew that going in. It has been a little slower to roll out. We've talked about this recently. The infrastructure has been a little slower to roll out than we initially anticipated. But also, just things that we didn't expect the customer to not be familiar with. Because even though it is very similar to fueling with a gasoline station, there are a few subtle nuances that can make the difference between calling the service center and saying, "Hey, I can't get hydrogen," or having a real easy transition to be able to fuel the vehicle. So there is a lot more training that we need to do.
Anything about the car?
Anyone that's familiar really with driving a Prius or electric vehicle, I heard this actually great story from one of our engineers on the Prius back when it first launched, where, all of the customers started calling when the engine would shut off and freak out. The car is broken. The engine just shut off. What's going on? So I think that people have gotten used to the quiet and the ready on light, and the people that are driving the vehicle are already really accustomed to electric vehicles. So in that area, in that sense, I don't think we've had any kind of strange feedback that we weren't already anticipating.
Oh, very good.
And
good for you guys.
The storage tanks, how do they compare in terms of the amount of space they take up inside the car to a conventional fuel tank?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, or fortunately, gasoline has an incredibly high volumetric and weight energy density. If you look at...
That's why we use it.
Yeah. That's why we use it. It's easy to transport. You can put it in a conformable plastic tank. So I'm not sure exactly what the exact correlation would be. I can say that these do take up quite a bit more space.
Yeah, I was thinking, as I recall from a previous fuel cell car that I drove, it was a car, which was wonderful. And then you opened up the hatch in the case of this one, and you saw, there's a lot of extra space given, dedicated to storing mm-hmm. fuel. So that's still, one of the packaging constraints that you've got with hydrogen.
The tanks are still a packaging constraint, yes, especially since they're cylindrical.
You don't have the option of making them look like saddlebags like
people
do with fuel tanks.
Yeah, you have to design around them. You can't have it as an afterthought. Like, here's a
10,000 PSI.
Yeah, exactly. But, the beauty is that this car is, twice as efficient as a gasoline vehicle. So even though you carry less fuel on board, you can get the same, 300 miles off of carrying less fuel on board.
Okay, another question from the audience. Armand wants to know, is there any regular service that you need to do on a fuel stack, and how long will the stack last?
So the stack does have a warranty. We wouldn't bring it to the customer unless we were comfortable that we could meet those expectations and the customer could have the vehicle for life. It does have the normal maintenance requirements check your tires, check your brakes, check your windshield washer fluid. There's obviously no oil. I'd say the most unique aspect is there is an ionic filter that you need to change out that is used for the fuel cell coolant that gets changed out once every 3 years. But otherwise, you're not dealing with all of those moving parts. You're not dealing with oil changes. It's actually a pretty easy car to maintain.
And that ionic filter's relatively cheap?
It has to be.
What's it look like? I've never seen an ionic filter. Is it like...
I don't even know what it is.
Is it like an air filter? Is it like, you know, sliding the air filter into your furnace?
A little different. I mean, we're dealing with removing the ions or changing the charge of the... In this case, we're trying to maintain the isolation resistance of the coolant that's used for the fuel cell stack. So I can show it to you if you want to pop that later. But yeah, it just looks like a small cartridge.
Okay, go yeah. And so it's not that different from changing the toner in your copier.
No, and luckily it's positioned quite easily for the service guys. So it's not one of those, you know, wonky positions where you have to remove, you know, the battery and this and that and the other thing to get to
like a BMW where you have to pull the engine to change a spark plug.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned Prius. This has a lot of Prius in it, doesn't it?
Yes, we borrow heavily from our hybrid sisters.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, so that's helpful in terms of the technology. So there's more confidence that you can put in a hydrogen system because knowing full well that you do have the hybrid synergy drive that's been proven out among how many bazillion Priuses and Highlanders and Lexi and whatnot.
Over 8 million hybrid vehicles now that we've sold. Yeah, and actually, this technology started the development at the same time as the Prius. So this is over 20 years of development that has gone into this vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it was a different, you know, we're waiting for the right time and the right place and the conditions and the infrastructure to be there. And so, yeah, that does give us mainly a cost advantage, but also we have a really high confidence in the power control unit in the motor, the electric motor, and the battery that we all borrowed from our production vehicles.
And so when the Mirai kicked off, wasn't it the chief engineer of the original Prius became the chief engineer for the Mirai?
It did.
So smart guy knew that this was for the future.
Yeah. There's a lot of smart people that worked on this car.
Including you!
Yeah. Jackie, General Motors has said, you know, the reason that, and I take this with somewhat of a grain of salt, General Motors has said that the reason it has not put a fuel cell car out there is that the technology is advancing so rapidly right now that anything it would put out on the street would be instantly obsolete. What's the value of Toyota actually having these cars where people can buy or lease them?
Well, this is an application, a space in our portfolio that we saw needed to be filled. And that was a zero-emission vehicle that was long-range and with a quick refueling time. And so we have customers that want to drive zero-emission vehicles, and this is really the option that fit their lifestyle the best. So for us, this is just one of the offerings of...
But it's very limited. This is really a glorified science experiment still, you know, and I'm not berating it. A very good one. No, I totally get you. But that's where I am wondering, what's the value, because you guys do zillions of miles of testing on this thing, what's the value of placing it in the hands of consumers and learning from that?
Well, certainly this is one step towards what we hope to be what this Synergy Drive has become, which is across a platform of vehicles. So we can offer this in an SUV platform, in a coupe platform, sports car, something that we're introducing to the public and they're getting familiar with, but also then we're learning so much that you can't learn from, regardless of how many engineers you have and how many miles that we drive it on the road in our test conditions or in the dyno cells. There's just something about getting into the hands of customers that you get all kinds of feedback that you would never otherwise.
Can you give us one, for instance, of something that you thought, ooh, so glad that the consumer gave us this feedback?
Oh, man. I would say most of it we learned from our previous generation vehicle, which we took all the learnings from the previous generation vehicle into this vehicle. And a lot of it was on just the feel of acceleration, how heavy the vehicle was, and then things like regen, when you're driving down a hill, you know, when you're going down a hill and you have the regen on, and so you feel kind of that deceleration, or you don't feel what's called runaway, where all of a sudden if the battery is full, then your generator stops kicking on the battery, and then all of a sudden you feel like your vehicle's accelerating downhill when really it's just that you've lost your regen. So that's something that we've taken into consideration with this vehicle. So that way you don't have that
loss. It feels normal at all times,
it
not all of a sudden start coasting.
Exactly. So then when the battery's full, it doesn't stop regenning.
And about how many Mirais are there on the road, you know, today? In California or total
globally.
Around the world? Whatever figure you have.
I'm not sure about globally. I know we're ramping up to hundreds in the U.S. We're looking at thousands, hundreds.
Hundreds in the U.S.?
Thousands.
Wow.
That's the time for the end of
that's
the year.
That's a lot for a car like this.
Yeah.
No, come on. They're making the Motomachi plant. That's a high production plant, John. They're just spitting these things out.
Yeah. It's a production plant. It's a full production plant.
Okay, we got another question here. Bob Wilson, you talked about the pressure of the tank. He wants to know, what about the internal pressure of the operating fuel cell? For example, does the air have to be compressed before feeding it in?
Yes, it's at a very low pressure, but it is pressurized. We have to maintain the partial pressure of the oxygen and the hydrogen to get the kind of electrochemical reaction we're looking for to maintain power, but also because the fuel cell is internally humidified. And that's a first, an industry first. No other automaker
has done that.
What's that mean,
that it's humidified?
So in order for the proton to hop across the membrane, like we talked about before, the stack has to be humidified. So it's a low-temperature fuel cell, because obviously if you go above boiling point, it's no longer humidified. But usually you have an external humidifier that provides a certain amount of water to the stack to maintain those right operating temperatures. For us, a cost reduction measure and a challenge given to us by the chief engineer was to remove the external humidifier. So the brilliant minds in Japan came up with this way of monitoring, you know, the airflow rate, what we're putting in with the hydrogen, and what we call the impedance, and being able to measure how much water was in the cell or model how much water was in the cell based on that to maintain the appropriate water levels. What that means, though, is that if it starts to get too wet, we'll need to kick up that compressor and blow the water out. So we need to have the capability to control the oxygen and the flow of the oxygen to the fuel cell stack. If it starts to dry out too much, you need to kick that down, let more water start to accumulate on the cathode, and then it's created on the cathode side, and then it has, through the design, the flow field that was designed in Japan, the water is able to go back over to the anode side and keep the whole membrane humidified.
So speaking of all this water, what happens when you guys go from California to Duluth? Is the fuel cell going to be frozen and not be able to work?
No, there is adaptive logic, and that actually was a big discussion point previously with fuel cells was, oh, they freeze, they can't start up in freezing temperatures, but they do and they can, and we actually had an easier time with our fuel cell vehicle in Yellowknife, Canada than we did with our rentals. But it does have a logic that it'll spool up, and with using the air compressor, it'll kick out all of the water, and then if you remove the water, then obviously you alleviate a freezing condition. Mm-hmm. And
so obviously, a fuel cell car will not lose range in the winter.
No, we don't.
Unlike battery cars,
we can see a substantial
reduction in range.
Yep, that is a big benefit because we are creating heat along with the water, and we are able to use that heat to warm the cabin instead of having to have an additional electric heater.
Why is this not called an electric car, though? I mean, it is an electric car, but you just don't plug it in, right?
I actually call it the electric vehicle unplugged, so you set me up for that.
Okay.
Yeah, it is an electric car. I'm not sure why it's not. Why battery electric is mainly, when you hear electric vehicle, everyone associates that with battery electric. But for us, since we offer all of these solutions, we call it battery electric, fuel cell electric.
But you have a battery in there, right?
We do have a battery in there as well, yeah.
I mean, besides the 12-volt battery that's running normal.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the BEV versus PCV, right? FCV, right.
Yeah.
Fuel cell vehicle.
Yes.
Versus battery electric vehicle.
Yeah, and they did. There was a time where they were trying to do FCEV, fuel cell electric vehicle. I don't know.
Well, that's what you guys called the Highlander when the Highlander was rolling around.
That was FCHV. That was a fuel cell hybrid vehicle.
Okay.
Because we wanted to take into account exactly what you mentioned, the battery that we also have on board. But I think a lot of people have trouble. It's part of the beauty of introducing the hybrid was people got used to this idea of the battery. But then once we said fuel cell hybrid, it's like, oh, well, there's also a gasoline. Are you also, you know, is there an engine in there? It's like,
right.
Yes, it's engine, but it's a fuel cell engine. So there's no fire, there's no spark, there's no pistons. So there is it's good that there's an understanding of what hybridization means, but then it realizes hybridization doesn't just mean gasoline and battery. It can mean fuel cell and battery.
Forgot to ask, so you can buy it or you can lease it. What's it cost?
It's $57,500 before the incentives.
And that's what, $7,500
yes,
credit?
Yes, and then they just reinstated, that's for California, and then also reinstated, I think, $8,000 on the federal level.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. That was just reinstated last December.
So you're looking at $15,500 total incentives, at least in California,
yes.
For this.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the lease price?
It's $4.99 a month.
Okay.
And that does include for a certain amount of customers the fuel, since we're still in the early stages of figuring out the fueling infrastructure. So it's a way to help kind of get our early adopters on board, the people that are taking this journey with us as we're starting to roll out more infrastructure, we'd like to have them have more options of where to go, where to drive the vehicles, redundant stations in their neighborhoods and things like that.
So is it available in Southern California and San Francisco or just Southern California?
Sacramento, Bay Area, and Los Angeles.
We've got several questions coming in. Dan the man, Mitchell, they all about infrastructure. Mitchell wants to know, have you considered installing hydrogen fueling stations at each Toyota dealership until the rest of the country catches up?
At each Toyota dealership?
Yeah.
I cannot say that I know of any plans to have done that. I can't say that we have in California in our eight dealerships that we have selected to be Mirai dealerships. That we have what's called a mobile fueler, which is kind of a real kind of toned down version of a hydrogen station to ensure that the customers have fuel just in case one of their local stations does go down. Mm-hmm. So we do have mobile fuelers ready that we can deploy, and those are what we use when we do our testing because obviously there's no hydrogen in Death Valley or Yellowknife Canada or any of those, so we take these mobile stations with us. So that could be an option, but...
Are these giant trucks, like they have giant tanks, like... be a version of these tanks?
Exactly.
Just driving around like that?
They do, yeah. Actually, that's how we got busted by a spy photographer in Death Valley because we were driving around the car and nobody really knew what it was until we pulled up to the hydrogen trailer. It said hydrogen on the side.
Surprise!
Yeah. So we got busted on that one.
Mike Ma from San Francisco wants to know, what's Toyota's vision for hydrogen? Is it going to power everything? Are we going to see full-size cars, CUVs, trucks, and... the next 5 to 10 years?
So we have announced plans to start to roll out about 30,000 vehicles a year in 2020.
That's a lot.
That is.
I mean, for this technology, that's a lot.
Yes.
That would be globally, I assume?
Yes. And the beauty there being that, you know, fuel cells can be scaled down to be small enough to power your cell phone or large enough to power your facility. We have a 1.1 megawatt fuel cell on the Toyota campus in Los Angeles. So there's a lot of opportunity there for... you know, anything from, you know, buses down to compact cars. So you could see it across the entire lineup. We also have what's called the hi-grid, this kind of image of integrating hydrogen into the grid. So you have the, you know, renewable electricity generation that you then feed to your plug-ins. Then you also have hydrogen as a storage from, you know, biogas or from electrolyzers in certain situations where it's all based on whatever your domestic, local, renewable energy source is. You feed the grid and you feed the hi-grid, the hydrogen pipelines as well, and are able to power your vehicles based on, you know, whatever vehicle you're driving. If you're driving the Prius Prime or you're driving the Mirai.
Do you drive one yourself?
Our group has a few that we have the pleasure of taking home, yes.
Uh-huh.
So I do. I take one home whenever I get the opportunity.
That's great.
And we were talking about the exhaust being, you know, just water, basically. But most people have never seen it. I mean, can you describe it? It's a trickle of water coming out of the, you know, exhaust pipe, right? And it's not hot or anything. It's, I mean, tell them what is the exhaust? If you owned one of these, what would you see?
It is. So since it's, as I talked about, it is a low-temperature fuel cell, so it has to be humidified. So the water itself is in liquid form. It's less than 100 degrees, obviously, so you can touch it. You can put your hands under it and feel it.
Can you drink it?
We don't recommend drinking it.
and it's a very small amount. It's not like an open tap coming out of it.
No, that was my question.
Yeah. You know, it's just drops.
It would be a good thing for California, though, if it were.
You know, I mean,
it'd be
there you go.
It's actually the same amount that comes out of an ICE, out of a normal gasoline combustion engine.
Interesting.
But because it's at a much lower temperature, it comes out in a liquid form, so it's a lot more, it's visible, whereas
in the cold climate.
You would never touch the tailpipe of a gasoline. And it also is what affords us the plastic covers that we have underneath the vehicle because there's no hot gases being exhausted. So we can cover the entire underbody of the vehicle, which improves the aerodynamics, improves the road noise. So it kind of sounds like a Lexus. It drives like a Lexus.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, here in the cold parts of the country in the winter, we see the water coming out of the exhaust pipe of the internal combustion engine.
Yes.
And that was my question to the Toyota people earlier was, what if we have millions of these cars on the road and they're all dropping water down in the winter, it freezes? And they were like, no. It's the same that comes out of a gasoline engine.
Yes, that's correct.
And millions of fuel cells on the cars. We'll worry about that in 2040.
I did the math. I did the math on that in one show.
Yeah.
Though.
We broke
it all down, so you're fine.
not to worry at all.
Yeah.
I'll just let you guys answer all the questions about that.
So does Toyota have an expectation for when there will be an infrastructure that allows fuel cell vehicles to be sold throughout a country? I mean, America's big, so you know, maybe not here, but is there someplace that you're looking at and you're saying, hey, in you know, Belgium, you know, we think there will be a full network of fuel cells by this time? Is there a forecast at all, or are you waiting for that end of the economy to take care of itself?
We're actually very involved with that end of things as well, which, I mean, we're not an infrastructure company. We're a car company. We're a mobility company. So we do all kinds of things beyond just the vehicle. But we are working so closely with, with governments, with academia, with other automakers to help roll out this infrastructure. And right now, the places that are really leading the way are California, Japan, and Germany. And they do all have plans of these networks of stations that if you optimize the placement of the stations where they're close to freeways, where you think the customers are going to be, the people that are going to buy these vehicles, then you really don't need as involved as the gasoline infrastructures right now. You don't need as many gasoline stations. So like in California, through all these studies and through route optimization and looking at vehicles miles traveled and traffic patterns, it came out to be 68 stations to support 10,000 fuel cell vehicles.
Throughout the entire state?
Throughout the entire state.
Great.
And so similar studies have been done.
But they're a couple of million bucks to put in one of them, right?
Less than a couple million, yes. Yeah.
Okay,
but
about a million five.
About a million, right around a million to put in the stations right now. So they are pricey, but again, when you put one in, you can fill a vehicle every 5 minutes, right? And so you get in and you can support not only us, but the other automakers with their launches as well.
Right, so Hyundai's got vehicles out there, and Honda's got vehicles out there, and... And aren't you doing something in the East Coast as well in the United States?
Air Liquide actually just made the announcement of the first, I think, four locations that they'll be placing. But we did partner with Air Liquide to put stations in the Northeast states to support rollout in, New York, New Jersey, that part of the U.S. as well. So we do see it kind of as a star on the coast and work your way in.
And is there a time frame for when that complete network that covers all of California might be in place?
We expect to have a pretty robust network by the end of next year, but by 2020, by the next launch, is really the target to have a really robust
San Diego to the Oregon line.
We should have San Diego before then, hopefully.
Yeah.
But all the way to Oregon. And we have the benefit of the hydrogen infrastructure already being in place in California. There's already pipelines. We already have hydrogen plants all over, and trucks that are transporting hydrogen over the road every day. Same with Texas, they have a very robust hydrogen infrastructure there. So it's really just about getting the dispenser in the ground and getting the hydrogen into the vehicle.
Okay. Great.
Jackie, with that, we're going to have to wrap it up. But this has been
already
fantastic. I know. Can you believe it? We just burned through a half hour like that.
I can't believe that just happened.
I know. No, but you've been terrific. This is an exciting development.
Can I take care of one more thing
before
I go?
Please.
Okay. Well, we brought you a gift, hoping that you would be able to.
So I'm going to open it right here, so everybody can see. Oh, this is great. So we've got a model, a little scale model of a Toyota Mirai,
okay.
And it's going to go up on the shelves here. So we're going to put
perfect.
A fuel cell, because we don't have any fuel cell cars. We have autonomous cars. We have ancient cars. We've got race cars. We've got hybrids. We've got plug-ins. We don't have a fuel cell one, so thank you.
Now you do.
For the Mirai, yeah. Jackie, thanks so much again
thank
for coming
so much
on
for
the
having
show.
Me.
That's great.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. We're going to be talking about some of the news of the week. Don't go away. And we've also got Dr. Data. So we're back. And it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so we've been talking on the show, I think we did last week and a couple weeks before that, about Gen Z and cars. And the argument, we started with the Kelley Blue Book Auto Trader research that seemed to indicate that, they're going to be buying cars left, right, and center.
And Gen Z defined that.
And this would be the people who are 16 and less in age.
16 and younger.
Right, okay. And I'm a little skeptical about this whole thing. I think there's going to be a change. I don't think the industry is going to be as robust as it was when say the three of us were growing up and cars were something that we really, 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 really wanted to have.
So because the Kelley Blue Book data said, hey, you know, Gen Z, they're different than Gen X and Gen Y. They want cars.
Right. So I happen to find some information from the Federal Highway Administration. And Carmen, can you show this, please? Here are
people 16 years or younger with driver's licenses in the U.S., and the chart shows fewer and fewer and fewer getting their license.
So in 2009, that number is 1.72 million, and in 2014, it's 1.08 million. So, I mean, look at that track.
Right. Fewer young people getting their driver's license.
What do you think, Mark?
I honestly think that people under 16 with their driver's license are such a small, weird sample that I don't know what to make of them, frankly. I mean, plus...
Well, this is 16 and younger, so this would be that when you were 16 years old, what was the first thing you did?
16 and younger.
So the first thing you did was...
That's interesting.
...to get a driver's license, right? So so they're just saying that in other states, you know, some states you can be 15 and get a license.
And I assume that includes the... You know, ways that a lot of states are, you know, making people wait until they're
graduated,
older to get
graduated licenses. Driver's licenses.
That's,
and
that's
like
all
that. Right.
Factored into that, I assume. That's an interesting figure.
So it doesn't look good.
Yeah. I don't know. I tend to fall into the category that, you know, until America becomes, you know, a country that believes in mass transit and supports infrastructure, people will need cars.
Right.
There will be certainly marginal changes around
Uber
what they
drivers.
Need, how they need. Whether Uber exists, whether Uber has drivers anymore, for sure.
That's a good point.
But I mean,
they'll all go to Lyft.
Yeah. But autonomous vehicles and ride sharing seem like a perfect match. You know, call the empty vehicle and it takes you where you want to go. So I feel like there are changes coming. I'm not on the apocalyptic end of the scale when I think about what the changes will be.
Yeah, I'm kind of along. It's going to be a gradual transition. It's not going to happen overnight, but I take it out 20 years, you're going to see big impact.
So if we take that line and go 20 years, even if it's at an incremental decrease.
Well, at that point, we'll have autonomous cars. You won't need a driver's license.
Do you need a license to call an Uber? No.
Right.
So that's our number for the week.
Very good. Very interesting. So what else is going on, Gary? You had made a list.
Speaking of numbers, did you see the Ford has opened up the subscription for putting yourself on the list to get a Ford GT? And so for all of you out there, you can go to FordGT.com right now.
And put your name on
the list. Put your name on the list.
Get one.
And is it sold out already?
I don't know, but if it hasn't, honestly, I'd be surprised.
I was surprised when I saw the number, though, what they're saying. You know, an average price, $450,000, and it's going to be only 500 vehicles.
Yeah.
And you do the math on that. So if just an average price, it'd be like $225 million worth
of revenue?
I still wouldn't count on them to make money on it, though.
Really?
I doubt they're going to lose their shirt.
No.
But you're right. It's a halo car.
And you have to give it. It's not just a halo car. It's a research car.
True.
Because, I mean, the real benefits of that car are going to be the carbon fiber, what they learn how to do with carbon fiber.
And a whole host of other
everything else they build.
That Gorilla Glass.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's a car that will pay off in a lot of other ways. But I would hope that my bonus wasn't tied to that particular profit line on that car if I was a Ford executive.
But to your point, Gary, I think the point you wanted to shouldn't Ford have charged?
Yeah, do an
Elon Musk.
Exactly.
And say, instead of make it a $10,000 deposit.
Yeah, but that money isn't really yours until you deliver the car. I mean, you know, if you look at Tesla, they show that all of those $1,000 deposits show up in their books as liabilities. You don't have that money to do with whatever you want.
No, but you got a pile of cash. You can do stuff with it no matter what the books say.
And if you're Elon, you get a great press release out of it. So maybe that's just the
point.
You
get a series of press releases out of it.
But even more than that, you can take that money and pay for tooling on it.
Yeah, so basically it shows up. It isn't income. It is a liability, but it is a pile of cash.
But it's a pile of cash.
Cash is king that you can use for your purposes, be they.
And if you're Ford, there's no way you're not going to have enough money to repay it. Worst comes to worst. Elon, 325,000 people each giving him $1,000. I don't know that he'd be able to cover that check if he had to.
he didn't tell them when they're getting that car.
Yes.
they're getting that car. Yeah. But it's sort of interesting that. And you guys reported on Daily about this, about how the Model S has had a refresh, the new front end.
New front end. Look, I love the Model X and the front end that they have on it. I'm a fan of the Model S, but just not that front end grille. It's the only ugly part of the car in my eye. And so they cleaned up the front end with the X. Now they've done it. And here we got the picture of the Model S with that new front end on it. And I believe the Model 3 is going to get it because, to me, the Model 3 looks so unfinished in the front end.
And that's one of the things that's very controversial about the 3 right now, the odd-looking nose and the very spare interior. Mm-hmm. And both of those, I think, are going to change.
The Model 3.
Yeah, and see how unfinished that looks like a ghost. That front, I'm sure it's going to get it. But
do you think they'll have that little cutout, that little mustache-like cutout on the up? So the lower grille will be there, but just something on the top fascia,
just the that leading edge.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sure, you want a family resemblance. It's like the kidney grid that BMW has had forever, even though it's evolved over time. But why not have that family resemblance? I think it would really make the 3 look much better.
You know, and I think one of the interesting things though is that. Here's the car company that, if we were to go back not that many years, many of us would have predicted it would have been gone, non-existent. And here they're doing a mid-cycle refresh. I mean, that's like, wow.
You got to,
They've been around sufficiently long to make that happen. Yes. That's the thing surprising.
That's a great point. But the other thing, too, is, at least according to Ward's statistics, sales of the Model S are down 40% in the U.S. for the first 3 months of the year. 40% is a huge drop. Now, I don't know if that means they're allocating production to other markets in the world. Maybe it is. But time for a mid-cycle refresh.
Yeah. Well, plus, there's a new model that all the buzz is around, too. I mean, the X. So, I mean, it makes sense. At some point, if you're going to be a business, you have to start behaving like a business. Mm. And you'll refresh it and make sure that you're not scavenging your own, cannibalizing your own buyers.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
You were mentioning, Mark, about how with the Ford GT that if you worked at Ford, you wouldn't want to have your bonus tied to that. It was interesting that the reporting came out of Germany that the German executives at Volkswagen may have to take a 30% cut of their bonuses.
Boy, they got a hell of a nerve taking any bonus at all, don't they? I mean, honestly?
Well, honestly, but think about it. What if you're somebody who has nothing to do with powertrain in Volkswagen? Let's say you're somebody who's not even in Germany, let's say you've done a bang-up job of running your operation.
But what they're talking about isn't, guy in charge of the plant in Puebla, Mexico, taking a cut. This is board-level executives talking about, gee, should I have to take a cut or not? And the board level, yes, I think that they are responsible for cuts.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
But to me, it's unfair that, if I did a great job running my operation and somebody else in powertrain screwed up, why should I have to give up my bonus?
You work for a company that broke the rules and it's paying tens of billions of dollars. I mean, where's the money's got to come from someplace.
Yeah. No, I'm just arguing for arguing's sake. I actually agree with you.
But Mark, you think they should have zero any percentage?
The board? The supervisory board? Absolutely. They're called the supervisory board. What were they supervising? And part of the problem, frankly, is they are the supervisory board, and what have they done to alleviate or address this problem in the 9 months since it became public?
Like next
they still
to nothing.
Don't have a plan. And that's what I think is unforgivable. I mean, that's, sure, they should have known something fishy was going on, but I can understand if they didn't. But this has been in their lap for 9 months. And do they have an agreement with the U.S.? Have they told owners what they're going to do?
No, they got an extension because they still can't figure it out.
They've got no route out of this yet.
In fact,
and that's what they should
have
done.
Isn't it next week they got to have the answer? It wasn't April 21 that they have to...
But I believe they've got an extension from that, but I could be wrong.
No. They had, it was March 21 was the first one, and the judge said, okay, I'll give you another month, and that's it.
Oh, and they've said, I think the latest is they've said they don't expect to be able to announce anything then, and the judge may have said, in that case, I'm going to set a trial date, which will be another 3 or 4 month extension, basically.
Right.
So are they going to buy a whole bunch of cars back, or are they going to plant a whole lot of trees? What do you think?
Honestly, I don't even want to waste time trying to think of what I think they should do at this point. I just want them to do their job.
What do you think is going to happen, Gary?
I don't think they're going to buy cars back. I think they're going to have some sort of software patch that will cause the vehicles to meet the requirements, but the vehicles will not have the same performance that they did previously. Remember when we first were talking about this and Harry Payne was going on and on and on about how it was so much fun to drive and so exhilarating and so on and so forth. I think Henry's going to be disappointed when they have the software patch for his car.
And how much will that cost them in lawsuits from owners?
A lot
probably
more.
A lot.
A lot more.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a good point, Mark. I hadn't thought of it. Because I believe they're going to buy him back. I think that EPA...
But, okay, they're going to buy him. Are they going to buy him back for the price that they would exist? I mean, what's the price in the used car market now? There is no price.
They're going to buy him back at
retail?
Book value plus a premium. For all the headache of us having to take your car back, I think that they're going to have to pay a premium in buying those cars back.
Okay, so if somebody has a diesel Volkswagen that is one of the ones that violates it, mm-hmm. and they bought it for, let's say, $18,000, and let's say they've had this car for 2 years, so are you suggesting they're going to get about 13 for this car?
No, I'm going to say that, you know, Volkswagen or whoever the intermediary is.
Whatever ALG
the
says
the company doing
worth.
The remediation is going to say, yeah, what's ALG or Kelley Blue Book or Black Book? They say with this year, with this many models, your car is worth this. So we're going to pay you that plus another $2,500 on top of it. Yeah. That's where I think it's going to
end. And one other question. What if, you know, some of these people don't want to sell their cars?
Well, in states that have emissions testing, you're going to have to do something to bring it into compliance. Yep. But most states don't have testing.
Right.
So if you love your TDI, yeah. you're probably going to keep it until the wheels fall off.
Yeah.
Because
or
the resale of it is not going to be...
Or there's going to be, you know, a court order that says Volkswagen has to get it back from you in some fashion.
And you can never bring it back to the dealer.
Right.
Because the dealers will be legally responsible to make that car compliant or pull it off the road.
Yeah.
So don't bring your TDI back to the dealer if you want to keep it.
Exactly. And there will be owners
outlaw
in that case
Volkswagen
who are even angrier.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they wanted to keep the car and they weren't allowed to. So, I mean, it's just, it's a hall of mirrors.
Get a personalized license plate that says, I don't care.
Yeah.
You'll have to peel my fingers, my cold,
my cold
dead fingers,
fingers
from the steering wheel.
Oh, man.
So, we were talking about infrastructure before. I thought interesting Ford announcing this week that they're going to spend $1 billion to improve the.
Well, they didn't put a price.
Good
on
for them.
But somebody estimated it's $1.2 billion.
Is the estimate that's out there?
Right. Is it?
Yeah, $1.2 billion.
I think it's going to be
good
phenomenal.
For them.
So for those who don't know, they're going to.
Yeah.
So basically, right now Ford has its headquarters, which is on the east side of the Southfield Freeway on Michigan Avenue.
Now are the renderings
the
for the new,
will
but not the headquarters. This is the renderings of the new engineering center.
And so this would be across the street from the
Greenfield Village
basically. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, I mean, everybody who follows the industry carefully probably has heard of the GM Tech Center a million times. Big modern campus, all the buildings work together where GM's done all of its engineering since 1950. Ford has had much more of a hodgepodge of buildings. They're all in the same area, but they're not connected. They're not as efficient.
They just got built up over the years.
Yeah.
Whereas the GM campus, which was opened in the late 50s, in fact, President Eisenhower came to the dedication. That's the kind of influence the automotive industry used to have. But anyway, it was designed by Eero Saarinen, very famous Finnish designer.
On the National Historic Register.
And it designed it as a campus, not just here's a cool building and here's a cool building and here's a cool building. But
in some ways,
GM's putting $1 billion into refurbishing that.
And if you think about the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that Toyota is spending on its tech center in Ann Arbor,
right. This
is a good time to be in technical development at a car company and a really good time to be a major contractor for real estate in Southeast Michigan.
No question about it.
I thought it was good and encouraging to see Ford say, you know what, we're going to take our heritage and build on it.
Absolutely.
Rather than saying, you know what, We're becoming a mobility supplier as well, and you know, the weather really is nice out there in Silicon Valley, and so we're gonna stay in Dearborn, but boy, we're gonna build this magnificent thing out there.
Yeah, Ford's always been an incredibly good corporate citizen of Dearborn, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have tended that town very carefully over the years.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, building these campuses, but that GM and Ford are both doing, and like you said, add that on to the, you know, the mega place that Toyota's built here, going to be a great recruiting tool. Mm-hmm. You know, when you come and you see, oh my God, if I walk from one building to the other, it's like taking a stroll through the park, and mm-hmm. there's going to be basketball courts and baseball diamonds and
picnic areas. Autonomous vehicles to take people from one to the other, and
right.
electric bikes that you can pick up to go from one
and
building
GM's
to another.
GM's talking fame. In fact,
exactly.
GM probably will beat Ford to the punch yep. with autonomous cars and electric bikes on its campus.
And that's part of what's fascinating, because it is Ford leapfrogging, really, from this hodgepodge of buildings that you described to absolute modernity. They're sort of, you know, they have been hamstrung by the fact that they've got people, you know, who have to run from
like
one building to another.
Buildings, right.
And
there's it's crazy.
All over, not even just Dearborn, but Allen Park and other
right.
neighboring communities. This mm-hmm. is going to be a massive improvement for Ford. And as you started to say, that when they're done with that in 2021, I think it is, they start another campaign to rebuild and expand the headquarters campus and bring in more facilities there. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's a massive program. Mm-hmm.
And I like that, you know, because the headquarters, the glass house, as everybody knows its nickname, you know, was built in the mid-50s, and it was kind of a very modern design for the day. Today, it no longer looks modern, and some of the renderings that they put out of how they're just going to change a bit of the facade of that building dramatically brings it into the 21st century.
And the building itself, they continue to use. And they're expanding and adding other stuff around it, of course. But it's not a teardown or anything. As you were saying, it's really honoring their heritage.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is kind of classical design, even though to our eyes now, being a half a century or more older, 60 years older, I'm glad they're keeping it. But freshening, you know, mid-cycle refresh.
Exactly. And it's a hell of a cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but think about it. You know, it'll look good for the next 60 years mm-hmm. or thereabouts.
Yeah. And I haven't thought about the recruiting tools, but you're right about that, too. I mean, having all of the, there's such a huge concentration of technical and engineering talent in this area anyway. But it's hard to get people to, you know, leave, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, for a brick building in Dearborn. And this is going to give them something that will make it a lot easier to compete.
You know, but I wonder about is you know, and you guys are probably familiar with this, the engine engineering building that is, would be the north of the, on Oakwood.
Yeah.
But north of the
Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, just a magnificent building from
the 1920s.
Yeah, I mean, and it's great architecture. And I mean, I hope they keep that. I hope that becomes part of that.
They've got
that campus rather than
saying,
okay, whatever is on the, what would that direction be? The west side of Oakwood, where the Product Development Center is now and the science labs are now, that's going to be the campus.
Give it
to the Henry Ford organization and let them do something with it. They're pretty badly landlocked as it is.
Mm-hmm. They put that building that Gary's talking about. That goes. Henry Ford kept his office there.
Did he?
Really?
Yes, he did. Right. I mean, he had several offices, but he spent most of his time there because their old headquarters was over by on Ford Rotunda, and it was this great palatial Italianate design. It was a beautiful building. Today, you wouldn't even know there was a building there today. Mm-hmm. It's just a field. Mm-hmm. But it used to be known as the Double E Building too. Not for electrical engineering, but for engine engineering.
Right.
But Henry used to keep an office there. And it, too, architecturally is reminiscent of the old headquarters building. So it's got this Italianate look. It's got the curved terracotta tiles on the roof and all that sort of thing. And supposedly, and I've read about this, Henry's office overlooked the parking area, and he could see who's coming in and out of the building. And if somebody was coming in he didn't want to deal with, he'd open the window and step out. So somebody would say, yo, go right into Mr. Ford's office. He's waiting for you. And they'd go in. There's nobody there.
And I wonder if Joseph Heller used that in Catch-22 with Major. He used to go outside his window when somebody would come into his office to see him. Could be that's where it came from. Speaking of the biggest non story coming out of Ford this week, I thought, was the story of that they did the autonomous driving in the dark. It's like, do we really think that our robot masters need eyes like we do to drive, that they need
lights? So what is that, Gary? They put out a release about this?
No, they made a big deal out of it, that we were able to drive around in the dark. And it's just like, okay, so you know, cameras that you're using for autonomous vehicles or even, you know, cruise control, you really don't need light. And LiDAR systems, they don't need to be in our spectrum.
Reading these street markings is one of the still big, tricky things going on.
And
it's more tricky with weather. But the fact that they have at least, you know, figured out that how to now do it in the dark is a step. It's not a huge step. I think I'd agree with you. I would not
I think it's just that we think that these systems need to, I mean, you know, computer vision is not human vision. And, you know, machine vision is not, you know, it can look at binary and say, oh, that's what it is. And, it, you know, we need images, makes us feel better. I just thought that was one of the sorts of things like.
It is kind of silly. You're right. I mean, it's autonomous. These things can see through just about anything. Nonetheless, having said that, there's so much misinterpretation and misinformation or lack of information on the part of the public. They don't get with us. I talk to people even within the industry and they go, well, we can only have autonomy when 100% of the cars are autonomous. And it's like, no, we don't have to wait that long. We can get going now. So even for Ford to come out and say, hey, we've been testing it in the light, in the public arena, people are going to go, oh, okay, good. So no matter how silly it seems to us, I think from a public standpoint, you got to put out all this information. We're testing in the snow. We're testing in the rain. We're testing at night. We're testing in every situation possible just to get the public used to the fact that, yeah, these cars will be able to deal with anything.
Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that some parts of the industry approached the government and said, and let's not rush quite so much. Let's be sure that we know how to do all of this stuff. And that we have standards in place, you know, before we start offering it. I think that's a good idea, too.
I think it's a semi-good idea. And the only reason I say not is because we know these cars are going to save lives. If we know that right now, today, over 100 people are going to get killed in the United States in motor vehicle accidents. And tomorrow, another 100. And the day after that, another 100. So
I leave the studio, I'm walking.
Right. And so, yeah, these cars are not going to be perfect, and people are going to get in accidents with autonomous cars, and they're going to get killed in autonomous cars. And we got to be very open and frank about talking like that. But instead of 35,000 people getting killed every year, it might only be 5,000. And to say, well, 5,000 people got killed in those cars, I'm saying, so what? And we're wringing our hands saying, oh, is this technology ready? And, oh, by the way, who's going to sue whom when these things fail? And I'm saying we lose by waiting. Every day we delay in bringing this technology forward, we're sacrificing lives. And so let's not make perfect cars the enemy of really, really good cars.
Well, and you can have so much improved safety before you get to anything that approaches full autonomy, too.
True.
I mean,
true.
Automatic braking, lane departure assist, just little things like that. When you think about how much that will help matters, particularly for inexperienced drivers, you know, for kids who are the ones who are most likely to get distracted or run into something they haven't dealt with before and get in over their heads. And I mean, those systems, well before full autonomy, they're going to make a huge difference.
This is why I love the new attitude at NHTSA. And I think Mark Rosekind is really bringing in, who's the guy, Anthony Fox at DOT, right? I think they're doing the right thing. They're saying, hey, look, we got to figure out a way of bringing this technology to market much, much faster. So instead of saying we're going to regulate automated braking and blind spot and cross traffic alert and all that kind of stuff, why don't you get together with us automakers and we're all going to, you know, cross our hearts and hope to die, and we're going to make this stuff standard by 2022. And then what Toyota do? They announced they're going to make it standard next year. So again, I like that attitude. And I like Mark Rosekind saying, hey, look, we got to get out with some sort of overlying rule for autonomous cars from a federal level, because we know you guys don't want 50 different sets of regulations in every single state. And to me, it's thrilling to hear Washington, D.C. regulators saying, come on, let's all get together and figure out how we're going to bring this technology much faster to the market. Because if we rely on the traditional rules writing process, it's going to take forever. I know I'm a broken record on this, but I keep coming back to the 1970s.
That's a record.
That's right. But anyway, how it took years to get NHTSA to agree to go from round headlights to square headlights. I think the rule writing process took almost 5 years to be able to do that.
And it all is it all speaks to an attitude that goes back at least to the work with the EPA that led to the 2025 standards, where you've now got regulators who have engineers on their team and who in many cases are engineers, and they want to solve problems too, and they're happy to work with other engineers to figure out what's the best way to do this, rather than the way that it was in the first round of regulations for safety and emissions 40 years ago, where people would just throw a dart and say this is what you got to do. So I mean, it's a much more cooperative, iterative process that you're talking about now, and that seems to work better for everybody.
Well, I think there's just an clearer understanding that technology is going to be moving forward regardless of whether you like it in terms of the rules or not. And therefore, you're either going to be with it or you're going to be eclipsed by it. And you might as well get ahead of the game rather than being a laggard. And but I think you're right, though. We're going to see this much sooner.
It'll happen fast. Because, Mark, the technologies you mentioned, the automated braking, et cetera, I think it's Boston Consulting Group did a study of it all. They think that alone could save 10,000 lives a year. 10,000! So, I understand there's some people who say, look, we got to make sure that this stuff is right. Well, let's not wait until it's 100%. If it's 99%, I say let's just go with it. Because I think, like I said, I did the math. It works out to about 108 fatalities every single day. And that's just in the U.S. Globally, it's way more than that. So we lose by weight.
The car thing is really dangerous. I don't know.
Right. Well, good. I think we've exhausted some perfectly good topics to talk about. So it's probably a good time to wrap up the show. Have you guys driven the Mirai?
I have.
Not yet. No, looking forward to it.
You'll drive it and you go, okay.
No, and that's a good thing.
It always
occurred to me that one of the problems with alternative hybrid or alternative powertrains is there's always the screen that shows you here's the electricity that's going here and it's going to the motor and it's going to the wheels and now it's going from the wheels to the and it's just like, you know what? When that goes away, when it just becomes another powertrain, who cares, right? You just say, okay, I want...
That's when you declare victory.
Right. You just say, I want this one that has this many miles per gallon and does this and has these features.
That's part of what's interesting to me about the Mirai as well, because they didn't make it... It is, as you said, a science experiment in many ways, but they didn't make it look like a science experiment. So it's a car that is maybe not for the really early adopters who want to be waving a flag saying, hey, look at me. It's just a car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. An unusual looking car, but a car. But that's the whole thing. So I think what we just have to say is that most people, you could just weld their hoods shut and they would never know what was inside it. Is that
that's
got
right.
an 8 in it? It's got a 4 in it.
That's like 90% of the car buying public.
Right. It's just, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Right.
It's like your phone. I mean, does it work? Does it not work? Mm-hmm. Do you have a quad-core processor? I don't know or care.
Yeah,
right. You know?
Right.
Yeah. I'm here.
So
cool. Okay,
anyway.
We'll wrap it up now. Yeah. Mark Phelan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Everybody can reach your stuff at freep.com.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
And see him live sometimes on there, or videos.
Some videos of me driving other cars and doing other stuff.
Yeah,
yes.
It's fascinating.
Okay, and we'll invite everybody to join you and I, Gary, for another episode of Autoline After Hours. Well, good. Okay, signing off. Thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.